think the way the House advocates of impeachment proceeded was badly wrong. I think it was impeachment malpractice.
You could have been that person providing that testimony.
And it would not have made any difference.
How can you say that?
Because
how do you
minds,
know?
Because minds were made up on Capitol Hill.
Former National Security Advisor John Bolton, whose book is out today, criticizing the way House Democrats ran the impeachment of President Trump in an interview there with ABC's Martha Raddatz. Well, Burbank Congressman Adam Schiff was the face of the House's impeachment inquiry late last year, and he joins me now. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Good to have you. Well, impeachment malpractice. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's a pretty weak defense, frankly, of John Bolton withholding information from the Congress and the American people at a time when it was very directly relevant to the impeachment. And he can't explain it other than, frankly, the fact that he was offered a lot of money for a book. There's no other rational explanation. He posits that it wouldn't have made a difference. His testimony wouldn't have mattered. But, of course, there's no way that he could know that. And, indeed, what he also goes on to say is the House should have looked into the other allegations that he makes in his book, but it doesn't explain how we were supposed to do that when he refused to talk to us about it. The reality is that there were people who worked for him who had courage and patriotism, who did come forward and did testify, and they have been, I think, shown to be great patriots, but John Bolton decided that he would rather save it for a book, and he'll have to live with that.
Well, he also says you were impatient to get it going and not wait for the courts to figure out whether he should be cleared to testify. Was there something to that?
No. You know, if you consider, for example, we did subpoena Don McGahn well over a year ago, and we are still in court trying to get his testimony. Had we gone to court with John Bolton and he threatened to sue us if we pursued it, we would still be in court trying to get John Bolton's testimony. So what has, you know, has been demonstrated is that was merely a delay tactic by Bolton. It's a delay tactic by McGahn. And we were not prepared, given that what the president was trying to do was cheat in the upcoming election, to wait another year, year and a half before we could get Bolton's testimony.
Do you think his testimony would have made a difference in the Senate when it came to the trial?
It certainly could have mattered to any number of senators. It would have made it much more difficult for them to ignore the evidence. It also may have led to other important witnesses. And that was, I think, the fear that Mitch McConnell had, which was it wouldn't be just Bolton, that Bolton would open it up to other witnesses, for example, that might be able to testify about the president's efforts to get China to help in his reelection, or efforts to let a Turkish bank off the hook to placate the Turkish autocratic leader. And so I think it's impossible for Bolton or anyone else to say what his testimony might have led to. But I think clearly for those senators who at least made the claim, even though it wasn't true, that there wasn't enough direct evidence that the president had extorted Ukraine by withholding military aid to get these investigations of the Bidens, they would not have been able to make that argument. And I think it was really inexcusable that John Bolton decided to put personal profit over the nation's interests.
Well, let's talk also about Roger Stone and his relationship to WikiLeaks and the Trump campaign. Some previously unreleased portions of the Mueller report now say that the president feared Stone might incriminate him. The special counsel's team doubted the president was truthful in written answers, stating he didn't recall discussing WikiLeaks with Stone. Stone says, or Stone's associate said that indeed Stone had told candidate Trump at the time that damaging documents would be released by WikiLeaks, damaging to Hillary Clinton. So what should we make of this? Is that grounds enough to open another impeachment inquiry?
That, of course, doesn't pass the smell test, and it looks even worse now that we know what Mueller found and the revelations that came out during the Roger Stone trial. Whether that's enough to, you know, warrant going forward, you know, again against the president in the months leading up to the election, you know, I think that's a pretty high burden to clear. But it does demonstrate, again, for the public just how dishonest this president is, how he's willing to make use of foreign help, solicit foreign help. And, you know, I think one of the most damning things about the Bolton book is the fact that this was clearly the pattern and practice of first soliciting Russia and then trying to coerce Ukraine into helping his election and then trying to get President Xi of China begging him for help in his reelection.
What do you think is happening now with respect to foreign interference in this election?
Well, I think, you know, the Russians are watching everything that the president is doing right now, and I think they see it as an open invitation to intervene again. The president the other day, and I think this was among the most destructive things he could do or say, and it was echoed by his attorney general, Bill Barr, was once again suggesting that foreign nations are going to be filling out absentee ballot applications or mailing in absentee ballots. He's basically trying to discredit the elections that haven't even happened yet. And of course, you know, the Russians are listening to this, and they know this is now something that they can exploit. And if they can help amplify those false claims by the president and cast doubt on the results of the election, they know what turmoil they can create, how much it can weaken our democracy. And it just is so destructive. But once again, echoing another theme of both the impeachment trial and John Bolton's book, this president does what's in his personal interest. It's all about what's good for Donald Trump. And right now, discrediting the results of an election that hasn't happened, he believes is in his interest.
Do you suspect that he is trying to lay the groundwork to ultimately challenge the election should he lose in November?
I think at a minimum, he is laying the groundwork to explain why he lost. But yes, I have to think that a president that made the false claim that millions of undocumented people voted in the last election, an election that he won, at least in the Electoral College, that he will be willing to make even more outlandish claims and lies in an election in which he loses. Now, I don't think the military is going to obey an unconstitutional order to try to prop him up in office. But I can see, if this were a close election, utter chaos resulting from the president discrediting the results of the election. And persuading millions of Americans that the ballots they cast by absentee are somehow invalid or shouldn't be counted. And so, you know, the remedy, in addition to what we put in the HEROES Act to require paper trails, to require support for absentee ballots and make sure they're secure, the other remedy that all Americans have is to make sure that every American votes, that this election is not even close. That's a landslide repudiation of the president. That's really, I think, the best path to stability after this election.
I want to talk a little bit about the events over the weekend with the Southern District of New York and the ousting of U.S. Attorney Jeff Berman there. Your colleague, Jerry Nadler, at the House Judiciary Committee, is preparing to subpoena Attorney General William Barr and investigate this whole incident over the weekend. What would you like to hear from that testimony?
Well, you know, I think Barr has done more to destroy the independence of the Justice Department than anyone in my lifetime. And, you know, I'd certainly like to have him face some tough questions over the destruction that he is wreaking. Why it is that he lied about Berman resigning, why it is he told the U.S. attorney in New Jersey a false statement about Berman resigning, why he intervened in the Flynn case, why he's trying to get his department tried to get a lesser sentence for Roger Stone, all the damage he has wrought, why he misrepresented the results of the Mueller report. Those are the tough questions that he should be forced to answer. But frankly, I think it's others that have the more important testimony. People like Berman, but also the prosecutors who worked on the Flynn case and the Stone case, and others who can talk about Barr's politicization of the department, shining a light on that, exposing that kind of craven conduct of the attorney general on the president's behalf is enormously important and probably more important than listening to Barr's false denials.
Now, locally, you withdrew your endorsement of L.A. County D.A. Jackie Lacey. You tweeted on Saturday that, quote, we have a responsibility to make profound changes to end systemic racism and reform criminal justice. Why isn't Jackie Lacey the person to do that?
Well, I have respect for Jackie Lacey, who I've known for a long time, and I certainly don't want to say anything to denigrate her. I'm going to rely on what I said in my printed statement. I think this is an opportunity to make a profound change in the criminal justice system, both locally in Los Angeles, but also around the country. And we are certainly in Congress trying to do that with probably the most comprehensive police reform bill ever introduced that would end the kind of qualified immunity that has shielded a lot of bad officers But there's more that I think we need to do in terms of independence of police commissions, civilian-controlled police commissions around the country. But I do think this is a rare moment for really demonstrable change, not incremental change. And I think we have to seize that moment.
Do you think that George Gascon is the person to do that, her challenger?
I'm not going to comment beyond what I have on the race already. I think my statement speaks for itself.
And do you agree with calls to, quote unquote, defund the police?
I don't agree if by defund people mean eliminate police departments, but I don't think that's what people really mean. I do agree that we ought to look at a lot of functions that are carried out by departments that are really not related to enforcement of the criminal laws, that go to mental health services or housing insecurity. And we ought to have other people take on those tasks. And frankly, I think the police departments would probably welcome not having to do as much of that work. But we also ought to think about our public safety budget in broader terms than law enforcement. How do we keep young people productively engaged? How do we make sure that we're not using the criminal justice system to treat substance abuse? These issues call for a broader approach than a one-size-fits-all law enforcement approach. And that I very strongly support.
Are you surprised at the pace of change on this issue? I mean, you yourself are walking back an endorsement. Mayor Garcetti as well has made noises that he wants to maybe reconsider his endorsement of Jackie Lacey. He's considering his budget request, reconsidering how much money he wants to spend on the police. Are you surprised by how fast things are moving and how quickly politicians such as yourself have had to reevaluate your positions?
I hope they're moving fast, and I think that they are. On many issues, you get to a tipping point where there's an opportunity for a very quick change. And we have to make sure that we seize that opportunity because, frankly, we have thought we were at tipping points with other issues like gun safety legislation when we had tragic shooting after tragic shooting after tragic shooting, only to see those opportunities for change slip away. And I think we have a profound opportunity right now to make systemic change, and not just in criminal justice, but in rooting out racism in the healthcare system, in economic opportunity. So I think this is a profound opportunity. We have to make it one. And that's going to require, though, a lot of sustained effort. But yes, I think that we have hopefully reached a tipping point where much more profound change is now possible.
Democratic LA Congressman Adam Schiff, thank you for coming on the show today.
You bet. Thank you.
Coming up, coronavirus cases at an all-time high here in California, and nursing homes are illegally evicting longtime patients to make room for COVID patients who bring in more federal money. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. California is seeing a dramatic spike in new coronavirus cases, even as the state continues to reopen more sectors of the economy. Yesterday, California broke its single-day record, recording more than 6,500 new cases. Governor Gavin Newsom also said hospitalizations are up 16% in the past 2 weeks.
We're not out of the first wave of this virus. Those that suggest we're out of the woods, those that suggest this somehow is going to disappear, these numbers tell a very, very different and sobering story.
Newsom says that a spike in cases could force him to reinstate some restrictions, although he hasn't given details on what that would look like. Here in Los Angeles, the epicenter of the state's outbreak, the county also posted a record number of new cases yesterday, more than 2,500. LA County Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer says the latest figures show an 8% short-term positivity rate, and that's a big increase from a couple of weeks ago when the county says that number was just over 5%. She says it's not necessarily because of the protests. She says it's likely because more people are out and about and socializing more.
The numbers do tell us that we're seeing an increase in community transmission. Now it's going to be very important to watch how this increase in cases translates into our daily hospitalizations over the next few weeks.
She says more than half of all deaths here in L.A. County are in institutional facilities, such as nursing homes. Let's take a look at some of the problems at nursing homes now with Jessica Silver Greenberg. She's an investigative reporter at the New York Times. And she found that nursing homes across the country have been evicting longtime residents to make room for coronavirus patients. Those patients can bring in more money for a nursing home. Jessica, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
It's great to have you. Let's talk about one facility you focused on in your story. It's called Lakeview Terrace. It's a skilled nursing facility in the MacArthur Park area. And tell us about what you found there and about the patient that you profiled, R.C. Kendrick.
A couple of weeks into the pandemic, so we're talking about April, we learned that the facility drove an 88-year-old man with dementia and a history of wandering. So his family had said that, you know, this individual, because he suffers from dementia, would often kind of escape in the middle of the night and no one would be able to find him. And so the nursing home, the nursing facility, Lakeview Terrace, drove this individual toward the evening one night to a boarding house, an unlicensed boarding house in Van Nuys, California, and left him there. His family, who thought that he was, you know, getting the care that he needed at Lakeview Terrace, had no idea that he had been evicted to this other facility until they received a call from the police days later. And the police had found this individual, R.C. Kendrick, crumpled on the sidewalk, disoriented and ranting. And he had no idea how he'd ended up, you know, 15 miles away from Lakeview Terrace where he had started.
Wow. Is that legal at all to do that? Just dump a patient in an unlicensed boarding?
No. Nursing homes are allowed under federal law to evict patients. And there's a number of reasons that they can do that to justify it. So there are six reasons. One is the failure to pay. So if someone can no longer afford the nursing home can evict the patient on that basis. Also, if the facility determines that the resident is a danger to others, they can also evict the resident. But the most important thing is that when these facilities evict a patient, they have to give 30 days notice under federal law. So they have to tell both the patient and, in some instances, if the patient does not have, you know, the mental capacity to manage their own health affairs, they also have to alert the families, and they have to alert the state watchdogs, who are called ombudsmen. So the facilities have to tell, at the very least, they have to give 30 days notice and tell the resident and the ombudsman when they're going to do an eviction. Another important piece that is important to understand the arc of Mr. Kendrick's ouster is that they also have to make sure that wherever they are evicting the resident to is safe and medically appropriate for that resident's needs. So in this case, when you have a patient with documented dementia, there is no universe in which an unlicensed boarding house that has no level of care, of medical care, is an appropriate medically safe facility. So it would be illegal on both of those counts, in my estimation.
Yeah, and in the estimation of L.A. City Attorney Mike Feuer, which entered into a $600,000 settlement with Lakeview Terrace last year. So there was supposed to be a monitor to make sure that the place was operating on the up and up. What happened?
So the monitor in March, as the coronavirus intensified in Los Angeles and across the country, the monitor had to stop visiting. In an attempt to stop the spread of the virus, the nursing homes have put very strict restrictions on who can and who cannot be in the facility. And that has worked to the advantage of some of these nursing homes who are committed, you know, the nursing homes that are committed to evicting as many residents as possible. The fact that there are fewer eyes and ears on the ground, fewer protections for residents in the facilities, has worked to the advantage of some of these nursing homes.
And the motivation to evict this 88-year-old man was to have his bed so that bed could be filled with someone who is recovering from coronavirus because the facility can get more money for that patient?
So we don't know the specific motivations to oust this particular individual, the 88-year-old with dementia, but what we do know is around the exact same time that he was evicted, we spoke to current employees at Lakeview Terrace, and you know they wanted to remain anonymous because obviously it's very important for them to protect their jobs, and they were worried about retaliation to describe what they were hearing and feeling. But what they said to us was there was a pressure to look for as many opportunities as possible to get out residents, lower paying, poor residents who are on Medicaid or Medi-Cal, as you call it in California, and bring in higher paying patients, coronavirus patients in this case. So nursing homes have long had this kind of financial motivation. So nursing homes, while we may think of them in the popular imagination as places that are mostly caring for older people at the very end of their lives, the bulk of their business, where they really make money, is on providing short-term rehabilitation care for people on Medicare, because Medicare reimburses nursing homes at a much higher rate than Medicaid. So in the coronavirus pandemic, as hospitals have suspended elective surgeries and even some kind of emergency surgeries, what we've seen is the stream of patients that nursing homes would normally get have dried up. So people who have just gotten a hip replacement, people who've gotten a knee replacement who need short-term therapy, they're no longer coming into facilities. The people that are coming into facilities, the cash cows, so to speak, are those with coronavirus.
So your story found that it wasn't just Lakeview. It was nursing homes across the country doing this.
Absolutely.
So this seems to be a systemic problem.
Yes, yes. So prior to the pandemic, families and residents complained about what these are technically called involuntary discharges. They complained to ombudsmen about these evictions like thousands of times a year. So complaints about these evictions are the biggest complaint that ombudsmen's offices get. In the pandemic, we found that it's basically the same problem, but on steroids. So the financial incentives are higher, and so are the consequences to residents and their families who may be evicted during this time. And we found just in the 4 months from March to June, we asked ombudsmen just how many involuntary discharge notices they were receiving. And we found that they received, just in that four-month period, more than 6,400. So that's a lot of people that's well more than just Mr. Kendrick at Lakeview Terrace, who's being evicted during this time.
And evicted to who knows where, right? I mean, in his case, the family didn't know where he was evicted to.
Evicted to homeless shelters, cramped, dingy motels, evicted to street corners, evicted. In one case, we found someone who was supposed to be evicted to a city office that was closed. So basically that meant they were going to be evicted to the sidewalk in front of the office. So there's a whole range of really inappropriate, unsafe places where residents are being evicted to.
Well, Jessica, thank you so much for your reporting. This is really a heartbreaking story.
Thank you for having me on here to talk about it. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. That's Jessica Silver Greenberg, investigative reporter at the New York Times. Coming up, Happy Pride Month. We'll tell you about TV shows you can watch about the LGBTQ experience.
All sorts of LGBTQ folks who traditionally were not on TV are now on TV every so often.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and it's time now for TV on the Radio.
Clear eyes, full hearts, get loose.
Oh my God, they've killed Kenny!
Three words for you. Treat, yo, so.
I am the one who knocks.
That's what she said.
Well, it's Pride Month, so let's celebrate by getting some recommendations now for good LGBTQ TV shows besides RuPaul's Drag Race. There's a list up at Rolling Stone right now, and we're joined by Jerry Portwood, digital director at the magazine. Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
Also joining us, Emily Vanderwerf, critic at large for Vox. Welcome back.
Hello.
Hello. Well, general question for you, Emily. Is Hollywood doing a better job at representing the community on TV these days?
I think yes, and that's a very qualified yes, because, you know, they're not suddenly doing like hundreds upon hundreds of portrayals of LGBTQ people, but they certainly are doing a lot more than they were even 10 years ago. And there's representation of folks like trans people, of non-binary identities, all sorts of LGBTQ folks who traditionally were not on TV are now on TV every so often.
And are they presented in a nuanced, complicated, fully human way?
Usually, let's say it that way. You know, there are certainly cases where that is not happening, and there are certainly still cases where, for instance, you know, trans people are portrayed as sex workers, which is the most common way for us to be portrayed. But we do have things like Pose. We do have things. We do have all sorts of shows about the experience of LGBTQ people in its many faceted, varied ways. And like, they are usually portrayed with nuance, with dignity, and with humanity.
Right. You, Jerry, in Rolling Stone, named 6 Feet Under as one of the top 40 LGBTQ shows to stream right now. That is a show from a long time ago. Talk about why you think it's still relevant.
Well, I have to think back to, I mean, I was in high school when I first started watching it, and it was something that we had never seen on TV before, not only because we were seeing same-sex intimacy and kissing, which it's hard for some people to remember, but that used to be so impossible that it never happened. And when it did, and often it was between two women, people would bring out the pitchforks and want to tear everything down, and there were boycotts and you know, legal battles. And then we had this show that not only showed true male-male coupling, but also the fights, all the ugly parts of it, all of the parts that we weren't supposed to talk about. I mean, there were moments of domestic abuse, which, you know, we rarely would ever see between same-sex couples or any queer people. And I think that was just as important as seeing all the love. And it really showed it that, you know, we hadn't been able to fantasize even having a loving bond with a lot of people who consider themselves gay or lesbian or bisexual or, you know, queer. And then we got to see it. And I was rewatching the finale again, and it still makes me cry and gives me chills. So, and we're coming up on the 20-year anniversary of that finale this summer, and it's still, to me, one of the best ever.
Let's play a clip of David and Keith, the same-sex couple at the center of 6 Feet Under.
Who were you taking care of when you sent Taylor away without even telling me? I mean, what am I, the dog?
I made a decision, and it was my decision to make.
Your decision? Why was it your decision?
It's my family.
I thought I was your family.
No, you're not. Yet. David, you're not. I mean, you just moved in here and all of a sudden there's this pressure to be, I don't know, whatever family unit fantasy you had in your head when you got engaged to Jennifer.
I care about Taylor. I think she feels at least as close to me.
It's not the point. It's not always about what you want.
Okay, so David and Keith. Keith is a cop and David is one of the sons in the family. And Emily, what was it about this relationship that was revolutionary to you?
You know, I think that we're so rarely shown LGBTQ relationships in all their colors. You know, if there are, if there is a gay couple, if there is a lesbian couple on a show, they're often portrayed as just like loving. And that's like the one thing we get from them. David and Keith, as we heard there, you know, they would fight. They would have real serious issues that like they had to overcome. It was not just a sanitized saccharine portrayal of a gay relationship for a presumed straight audience. And I think that was revolutionary.
Let's fast forward to the series Billions. It has a non-binary character. And Emily, can you tell us about Taylor Mason?
So Taylor is this character who joins in season two, and they are a non-binary analyst for Axe Capital, which is this business firm at the center of the show. And one of the things about Billions is it's kind of a hyper-masculine, hyper-heterosexual, like just all of the things you would not expect from a series that would have probably the first major non-binary character in television history. And yet Taylor, who is played by the non-binary actor Asia Kate Dillon, is just really a fantastic, compelling presence. And one of my favorite things is how the show codes villains by having them refuse to use Taylor's they/them pronouns. If a character comes in and uses the wrong pronouns for Taylor, you know they're bad.
All right, let's play a clip from Taylor.
Do not feel obligated to attend.
Okay.
Why are you missing it, by the way? You don't want to party with me?
It's my sister's wedding. Rehearsal dinner on Mackinac Island in the UP. Michigan.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Not a lot of flights.
You're rich. They're called private planes.
I almost booked it. Just don't know if I can actually get on it. The carbon footprint alone is...
You're really that worried about the world ending?
Yes.
What about your own world?
Not so much.
Jerry, is this on your list? Billions?
It is. And it's interesting because some of my friends, even queer friends, were surprised. They were like, I never think of that show as an LGBTQ show. And I'm like, well, that's actually why it's great, right? Because it actually has a character who is just naturally in this world rather than it being so focused on a coming out experience or some sort of struggle about gender or sexuality.
Another show on your list that I really like and my kids love is called Steven Universe. For people who don't know about it, can you talk about that one, Jerry?
I can a little bit. I mean, that actually is one of my TV critic Alan Sepinwall's favorite TV shows, and I wasn't aware of it until he wrote his huge ode to it, and I did watch it. And it is such a spectacularly sensitive and joyous and beautiful story, but it's so strange. And I think to adults, it's even weirder because kids just think of it as normal, whereas we're like, what in the hell is going on? You know, like this is, you know, that people are just changing bodies and changing shapes and all things. It's just so, kind of everything, which it's hard for, I think, us older people to wrap our heads around.
Right. Emily, what do you think about it?
You know, Steven Universe is not my favorite show, but I really love the way that it's introducing kids to all sorts of concepts and ideas about, you know, the multiplicity of ways in which humans can be people, and also in the way, in like metaphorical ways. So it's not just like hitting you over the head with lessons, like the Gems, who are the group of people who sort of help raise Steven, are just like this wide variety of you know, LGBTQ metaphors, I guess I'd say. I don't know if I would specifically call them people in that regard, but like they are really well presented and really well developed in a way that suggests, you know, just ways that kids could like look at the world a little bit differently.
Okay, finally, let's talk about this new drama Netflix debuted in March. It's called Feel Good, and here's a clip.
Hi. I've never been on a date with a girl before.
Do you like films?
Do you want to kiss me, mate?
Oh, that would be so cool. Now?
Yes.
Emily, do you like Feel Good?
Oh, I loved Feel Good. I think that Feel Good is one of my favorite new shows of this year. I really love the actor Mae Martin, who is the lead of this show. And I love the way it tells a story about a loving relationship between two women that, again, gets complicated in the same manner of David and Keith. And then toward the end of season one, I'm not going to spoil this, there is some really interesting trans content. I'm trying not to say too much because it is kind of a story turn, but like I really love the way that trans representation was sort of looped into the show in the way it would in real life.
Jerry, speaking of trans representation, has it become not surprising to see this? I mean, we've been talking a lot about trans representation in this segment. It seems like a lot of shows are taking this on and making it pretty much an unremarkable part of life.
Yeah, and I think first to kind of reiterate what Emily said, you know, we do have to acknowledge that because of streaming, we're able to tell so many stories that probably wouldn't have gotten through the gates, that would have been, you know, not greenlit by a lot of probably cisgender white straight men. And now we're getting these kinds of stories partly because there are so many new platforms and ways that these, I'm calling them TV shows. Sometimes I don't even know what that word means anymore. So but we are telling these stories on screens and being able to get them to people. So I think that's one reason why we do see trans stories show up. I don't think there's enough. I do think that, you know, shows like Pose are a beginning. That's also a history show. I mean, it's about the 80s and 90s, and it's important to look at what we're doing now and in the 21st century as well. And I think that we won't even be saying, you know, this is a trans show. We're just going to say, this is a great TV show, and it may have queer people in it. It may have, you know, people who are in same-sex relationships or polyamorous relationships. There's so much that we're seeing that is just something that just 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, we wouldn't have even imagined possible.
Jerry Portwood, digital director at Rolling Stone, which has a list of the top 40 LGBTQ shows to stream right now. Emily Vanderwerf, critic at large at Vox. Thank you both so much.
It was great to be here.
It was great to be here. Thank you.
All right. When you're not watching TV, why don't you go outside and go for a hike in Griffith Park? We're going to tell you where exactly you should go next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, how much do you know about Griffith Park? Okay, sure, you probably know the basics. It's pretty big, huge, in fact. It's a good place to hike. It's home to the observatory, to the Hollywood sign. But beyond that, a lot of us take Griffith Park, one of the largest city parks in North America, for granted. Casey Schreiner is the founder and editor of the hiking blog Modern Hiker. His new book is the first in-depth guide to all of Griffith Park's 4,300 acres. It's called Discovering Griffith Park, A Local's Guide. And Casey Schreiner joins us now. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me back. It's my great pleasure to be here.
Well, it's my great pleasure to have you. You are a local, in fact.
I am.
So how much time do you spend in Griffith Park?
A lot. I've been in LA now for 17 years, and I've lived basically at the foot of Griffith Park for seven. And I spend a lot of time in Griffith Park.
So you thought, okay, since I spend so much time there, I should write a book about it?
Well, it was partially because I do spend a lot of time here. And, you know, when you're writing a hiking guidebook, I've written one before called Day Hiking Los Angeles that kind of covers the broader LA area. And the thing with a big guidebook is you put a lot of miles on your car. So I figured at least with this one, I could walk to a lot of the trails, which is a very special thing to do. And also when I realized that no one had written a book about Griffith Park like this before, I was actually kind of shocked. So I figured if someone's going to do it, it might as well be me. And it might as well be right now while I'm living so close to it.
Well, okay, let's dive into it. Let's get a brief history lesson. At first, it was originally home to a Native American tribe. And how did they use the park?
Yeah, so as a very, very brief, extremely truncated history of Griffith Park. So the land of Griffith Park was originally home to the Tongva or the Tongva Gabrielino people. And most folks kind of know about the area near Ferndale was the site of a kind of a council meeting ground, trading post area. Actually, new scholarship has found that there's actually maybe two or three more settlements inside Griffith Park that were Tongva settlements. Of course, when the Spanish came in, most of the Tongva were pushed out or exterminated or put into the mission system. So the land kind of came into Spanish hands with in the Los Feliz family. And the first landowner of the Rancho Los Feliz was actually one of the original pobladores, the 44 soldiers and families and soldiers that founded the Pueblo of Los Angeles, stayed in his family for generations through kind of being in New Spain, then part of Mexico. Then the land became part of the United States, went through a couple different American landowners before it landed in the hands of Griffith J. Griffith, who was a Welsh kind of rags to riches story that moved over to the Western United States and made quite a name for himself out here in LA.
Griffith J. Griffith, why did he have the same first and last name, first of all?
Apparently that's a thing in South Wales. I did not know this, but apparently like that's kind of a pretty common occurrence over in that part of the world.
All right. So he and his wife eventually donated their land, which I guess is at that point was what, about 3,000 acres. They donated it to Los Angeles.
Yeah, so it was around a little over 3,000 acres. This was December of 1896, and they donated the land to the city of Los Angeles as a Christmas present, specifically for use as a city park. So let's remember, 1896, you know, at this point, LA is pretty much kind of a backwater town. Like, people are starting to move here, but we're still probably second, third, maybe even fourth or fifth fiddle in terms of, you know, cities in the state of California. You know, San Diego was bigger. Santa Barbara was more important. San Francisco was the center of power. Like, LA was really nothing. And then immediately overnight, we have a park that's significantly larger than Central Park in Manhattan. And it's so big and it's so remote that Griffith Park wasn't even inside LA city limits when it was given to the city in 1896.
And was it still wild, mainly? It didn't have any of the manicured lawn parts that it has today?
So at this point, the sort of the chunk of Rancho Los Feliz that became Griffith Park was pretty rugged. There was some development there. It was not, you know, sort of untouched land. The rancho had been there for quite some time. One of those buildings is actually still there. It's the park's film office, which is right near the visitor center. There'd been like kind of a rough and tumble golf course over there and a few kind of uses for recreation. An ostrich farm as well was kind of near where the old LA Zoo sits right now. So it wasn't definitely like, you know, pure wilderness area, but most of that land was pretty rugged and kind of difficult to develop. So it was fairly pristine when it was given over as a city park.
Can you talk about the old LA Zoo? Those cages are pretty crazy. I know.
Yes.
I've spent a lot of time in that area, and I've always wondered about the animals that were there and how they lived and just the origins of those things. Can you give us a clue?
Yeah, of course. So actually, the old LA Zoo is a pretty well-known spot in Griffith Park. You've seen it in TV. You've seen it in movies. You have probably seen it in like actors' headshots with people trying to look super cool and creepy. You may have seen it on one of the haunted hay rides in Griffith Park during, you know, Halloween season. That actually it was not the first zoo in LA, but it was one of the earliest zoos. And it kind of sits near where the ostrich farm Griffith and one of his business partners kind of co-owned and ran over there. And by all accounts, the old LA Zoo was kind of always a black eye on the city of Los Angeles. It was really not a nice zoo. It was well behind modern zoo standards. There was stuff about like sewage leaking into the LA River. And there was one particular polar bear named Ivan the Terrible who had a habit of murdering his fellow polar bears. So it really was like not something that the city was necessarily proud of. And that actually, you know, kind of got the city behind the bond issues and the long drawn out process that got us our current zoo, which by all measures is significantly nicer than the old LA Zoo ever was.
So how did it become the park that it is today? It's got the observatory, the Hollywood sign. How did that happen?
Yeah, so Griffith Park has grown quite a bit since it was founded. You know, as we mentioned, when it was sort of given to the city, it was pretty undeveloped and kind of, you know, not a blank slate, but it was fairly blank. Griffith himself did donate money for the Greek Theater and the Griffith Observatory. Those were things that he had sort of planned to build inside the park. He also, of course, envisioned some golf courses as well. And he and his son Van kind of kept land near the golf courses. And there was an aviation park inside Griffith Park for quite some time as well that became a National Guard airfield for a while. Griffith Park has kind of always been this sort of land of many uses. Even when Griffith donated it, he envisioned it as, you know, partly manicured gardens, partly golf courses, partly that sort of classic, you know, European East Coast city park. But also it was important for him to have that sort of untouched wild chaparral slopes in there as well. So Griffith Park has always sort of been those two things. And, you know, they haven't always been playing well together. They've always kind of been at odds. And you get people who want more development. You want people that want less development. And as the park grew and sort of expanded into Mount Lee, where the Hollywood sign is, some of the neighborhoods around the Hollywoodland housing development, and then more recently into Cahuenga Peak on the west side. It's definitely always had that sort of struggle of what is Griffith Park and who is it for, and what belongs in which sections of the park.
But it's always been free. And I guess when he donated it, that was one of the conditions, that it remain free. And that was pretty progressive at the time.
It was very progressive. Actually, Griffith wrote a book about his park philosophy. It's called Parks, Boulevards, and Playgrounds. I think he wrote it around 1910. And in this book, he's got some pretty forward-facing ideas about the importance of parks for cities and how cities should treat their parks. He described Griffith Park and parks in general as a safety valve for city life. So this was not just a nice luxury that, you know, a city should have if it could afford it. Parks were a necessity for people who lived inside cities. Then he really, really held that value true to his core. He also wanted parks to be free, which is why in the deed to Griffith Park, we can never charge an admission fee to enter the park. And in his book, he really wanted people to be able to get to the park, even if they didn't have a car or access. So he envisioned actually a system of tree-lined boulevards that would lead into the more developed areas of Los Angeles so that people could kind of have a park experience as they traveled to the park. He kind of envisioned it on trains, although of course that never really happened, but those are all still battles that we're kind of still facing today with parks in LA in terms of park access, who can afford to use a park, and how can we make parks easy to get into if you don't have a car.
All right, so let's get to some of the hiking trails, because you are a hiker and you love to hike. What are some of the better ones and the less traveled ones?
Yes, so Griffith Park has this reputation of being really crowded for hiking trails. And in parts of the park, that is true. If you are kind of around the observatory, or if you're trying to get to the Hollywood sign, you're not going to have like a solitude experience in Griffith Park, but you can get that experience. It's actually not very difficult to be the only person on the trail. I actually recommend the northern side of the park and the eastern side of the park tend to have much less frequently visited trails. Those tend to be more equestrian areas. On the east side, a lot of trail runners use that area. It's not nearly as crowded as it is around the observatory. So if you're on the north side, there's a really great trail called the Skyline Trail that kind of goes from Traveltown to the LA Zoo. You get this really beautiful view looking north, kind of across Burbank to the Verdugo Mountains and the San Gabriels when it's clear. You can see the LA River right below you. There's a big chunk of it where it's soft bottom, so it looks like a kind of a naturalized river. And there's you can have this really awesome kind of perfectly unique, perfectly LA, perfect Griffith Park experience there, where you're looking at this territory. Maybe you see a line of horseback riders come up in their cowboy hats and you're kind of humming a Western tune in your head. Maybe it's sunset and you have this experience of, how can I be here in the middle of the city like this? And then you look to the north and you see North America's largest IKEA over at Burbank. And you're like, yeah, this is pretty much the quintessential LA experience right here. It's all those things. It's wilderness, it's chaparral, it's built up areas, it's civilization. It's kind of a big, wonderful mess, I think.
And do you think that there are still places where you can be all by yourself, isolated? This is a park that attracts millions of visitors a year. It is well trod. It's 125 years old, after all, or it will be next year. So
yes.
Are there any undiscovered corners of Griffith Park?
Well, I don't think there's anything that hasn't been discovered in there, but your act of discovering Griffith Park can actually be really rewarding. There were several trails that I hiked for the book that I had never really hiked on before. And they're not, you know, they're not hidden trails by any means. They're on the official park map. They're named, they're signed. They're just a little out of the way. There's not really a quote unquote like destination or a highlight to some of these trails. But I did have several experiences where I was, you know, either alone on the trails or maybe there was one or two other people that I passed while I was there. And these are like weekend afternoons when I was hiking. So it is definitely possible to have some peace and quiet and solitude in Griffith Park. You know, as long as you're, you know, not hiking on the weekends, late morning, perhaps, you know, if you can get in there on the weekday, that's even better. Or if you can get in there super early, you've got a pretty good chance of having some peace and quiet.
Casey Schreiner, he's the founder and editor of Modern Hiker. His new book is called Discovering Griffith Park, A Local's Guide. Casey, thank you.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
And that'll do it for us today. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to the Press Play podcast and listen wherever you want, maybe on a hike in Griffith Park. It's at ksrw.com/pressplay or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.